from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. It's been a while since we've had Blink on the show. Blink, as you'll know, is our sister blogger, blinkoncrime.com. And we're going to talk a little bit about Jinxed. And when you wonder what that's about, I guess that's why Blink is here. Good, happy Easter, good evening, whatever it is. Hello.
All of the above. How are you, Dana?
I'm good. How was your Easter?
It was wonderful, thank you. Very packed. A lot of family, a lot of friends. Very blessed. But wonderful. And it's spring here.
Yeah, it's not spring. It's not spring here, and that's all I'll say. I actually had the snow. I had the snow blower going today, so it was awful. Anyway, we might as well get right into this. There's lots to talk about. A fella by the name of Robert Durst, someone who you've been talking about for a while. And the HBO documentary Jinxed, and of course the open microphone and all of that. For the listeners and those that don't know what I'm talking about, let's just give a little bit of a general about Mr. Durst and the HBO documentary.
Sure. I'll start with some background. Robert Durst, I guess most refer to him as the scion of real estate, is part of one of the legacy families in New York City. His family owns and has owned, I want to say, for about a century or five or six properties within the Times Square vicinity, as well as they were recently granted the right to lease the new Freedom Tower, which, as you know, is if it could be a replacement, the replacement for the Twin Towers,
right.
Twin Towers 1 and 2. He is the product of, he says, a mother who at the age of 7 committed suicide by jumping off of the roof of the Scarsdale family home, went through a ridiculous amount of psychotherapists, and was actually diagnosed with Asperger's at one time, schizophrenia at another time. However, he was at top of his class, graduated from Lehigh University in 1965, which is about 10 minutes from my house, and was one of these schools that my daughter looked at in terms of possibly enrolling in the fall of this year, and was eventually arrested in a Wegmans, which is where I used to shop when I live locally. And he started out being a suspect in the disappearance of his wife, Kathleen Durst, in 1982. They'd been married about 10 years, a little over 10 years, and Kathleen was a fourth-year medical student at Albert Einstein Medical Center in the city. Eccentric gentleman, for some reason, and I'm still not clear on, had a bunch of aliases from an early age, but he was an achiever. He was a varsity lacrosse player. He did well in school. Did not show, you know, those earmarks of somebody with a troubled psyche, if you will, at least not on the surface, you know, as he was developing. Was a varsity lacrosse player. He did well in school. Did not show, you know, those earmarks of somebody with a troubled psyche, if you will, at least not on the surface, you know, as he was developing. Through the years, he, you know, as kind of like a police blotter, he is the suspect in his wife's disappearance. He is a suspect and now the subject of an indictment of his best friend and confidant, Susan Berman's murder in 2000. He was acquitted of murder in a Galveston, Texas courtroom. He wasn't his roommate, but he was shared the apartment next door to him, a guy by the name of Morris Black, who he admitted to dismembering, but did not kill, he says. And that's about the laundry list to date in terms of just the background.
How do you dismember but not kill?
Intentionally.
Oh, I see.
Intentionally. Yes, he said he did kill him in self-defense.
Oh, I see.
The gun went off, and the reason why, in my estimation, that he was acquitted of that crime was because there was no cause of death, because the gentleman was, he says, took a bullet in the head, and the head was never found. So there was no cause of death, and there was no manner of death. So what he was found guilty for was abuse of a corpse.
Right. No, he took the body, put it in a suitcase, threw it in a river or something like that?
I believe there were 12 garbage bags in a suitcase, if I'm not mistaken, yes.
What the hell kind of a suitcase can hold 12 garbage bags?
In addition to the suitcase.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yes, in addition to the suitcase.
All right.
I'm not positive that the suitcase has ever been found.
All right. Okay. I'll smarten up now. Blink from Blink on Crime is here, and we're talking about Robert Durst. Now, what about this? And we're going to get into the legalities and the hidden microphone and going to the canon and all that stuff in a little bit. But what about the HBO docuseries Jinx, J-I-N-X?
Well, if this was a work of fiction, I would call it one of the most brilliant documentaries I've seen in a long time. And I'm going to apologize to you and the audience up front, because for me, Robert Durst is so criminally interesting, if that makes sense. I find him fascinating.
Yep.
He is almost not profilable in many ways, or defies, you know, standard empirical data or case study. But Andrew Jarecki put out a movie called, All Good Things, All Good Things, in which, first of all, he studied Durst for years and years and years. It was starred Ryan Gosling and Kirsten Dunst.
Right.
And as a result of that film, it actually ended up where Durst called Jarecki and proposed that he do a documentary on Durst. And as I wrote, he proposed that notion because he says, Robert Durst, that he felt that because he never spoke publicly, that the public absorbed, you know, whatever commentary that they read or that they heard, and they did so because, in addition to that, the media would say whatever they wanted because it went unchecked. Because they knew he was not going to refute it, he wasn't going to speak, you know, to the contrary. And he said he felt that if people were reasonably open, that he felt he would be able to present his side in a way that he felt was true. And if they were reasonably open, they would be able to at least entertain the notion of a different side of the story, using the word story, by the way.
Right.
Not the truth. So throughout, you know, it depends on, you know, I'm going to throw out what the problems are with the docuseries in the first place.
Okay.
Chronologically, it's inaccurate as presented. And when I say that, I'm saying if I am a layperson and I'm strictly looking at the entertainment value of it, which one could, for sure.
Sure.
It's beautiful. The cinematography is fantastic. I expect it will win an award for cinematography and or editing. I'll say that as a prediction. But also, if one is looking at it, it appears to occur chronologically, and that is absolutely not the case. And it is not pointed out to many journalist satisfaction that there is a 2-year lag between the first interview and the second interview of Robert Durst, which, as you briefly mentioned, when Durst has this bathroom confession, if you will, for lack of a better term, it gives the appearance that this is an unfolding scenario over this filming, and that is not accurate.
Blink from Blink on Crime is here. We're talking about Robert Durst and the docuseries on HBO, Jinx. Now, Durst, we'll use the term evil genius, maybe. I don't know. But what about the letters? The letter, the cadaver, and all that sort of stuff. And that evidence all of a sudden pops up many years later. Somebody's going through some old files or an old box or something and has the letter they're able to compare. It's right out of a book, for sure.
Sure. And to answer your point about, I think you mentioned evil genius, he is completely diabolical. I absolutely, completely believe this gentleman is way smarter than most people that have ever interviewed him, most people that have ever probably analyzed him and tested him, and way smarter than he lets on. I also think when you say evil genius, I also think he has some serious psychological issues.
Sure.
That may or may not compel him to do the things that he does and respond. And that's not an excuse. My point is, I just think he's highly underestimated for what he has gotten away with to date, that I do think he is at least culpable for, is kind of astounding. You don't see that every day. And I don't blame it entirely on the fact that he has, you know, unlimited resources, because his resources in comparison to his family, as of about 2006, might be an eighth. I mean, they literally negotiated a deal by which he was cut out of the entire enterprise for, you know, a meager $65 million of a nearly $900 million empire.
Jeez.
You know, exactly, who he was the heir apparent to many years before.
Right.
I personally think that had to do more with the fact that he went on trial, and perhaps in his mind he thought he would always be a suspect and would need those, you know, funds, etc., going forward. But as far as that's concerned, and as we, you know, as we get into his issues and those kinds of things, I think that when we talk about the, you know, you mentioned the letter, and
right.
I assume what you're referring to is the one that was uncovered by Susan Berman's adopted son, Sarab Kaufman, within the Jinx, where
yes,
it clearly showed similar lettering,
yep,
a mistake in the word Beverly in terms of Beverly Hills in the address, and you know, Andrew Jarecki kind of does a gotcha interview with him with regard to that type. My take on that is a bit different than most that I have seen. I personally believe, having reviewed this documentary at least three times, that Durst was aware that he was about to be confronted with this. And I'll tell you why. Years ago, he was court-ordered to provide exemplars of his own handwriting, which Jarecki was in possession of, but also he knew what it was being compared to at the time. I find it very hard to believe that anybody is going to surprise Durst, because in the first interview he actually does use the word exemplar. That the original cadaver letter, if you will, was shown to him in the first interview. I don't believe for a second he didn't suspect that he might be subject to further questioning on a comparison, since he was court-ordered to do so many years prior to that.
How did he reply, or how did he respond when he was shown?
The first interview, when he was shown, he mentioned that Beverly was misspelled. There was block lettering that he felt was used by the offender to mask their handwriting.
Right.
And clearly, and this is a very important point, clearly that letter was written by the killer. It could only have written by the killer, and that killer, quote unquote, took a risk by writing a letter to the police. And
why, though? You know, I can think of BTK as another example. Why do these offenders, why do these killers, why do these crazies write these letters? Is it just a game for them?
I don't compare Durst to BTK, because BTK was a psychopathic egotist who was in a position where he was not able to kill anymore, so he was living out his fantasy through taunting law enforcement.
Right.
That's a little bit different. With Durst, the working opinion is that he sent that letter because he genuinely cared about his friend and did not want her decomposing on her floor with those dogs running in and out.
Right.
Perhaps it had to do with the fact that there were other investigatory acts that were going on around him, and he wanted them to stop immediately. And that is the notion. The notion is, or what the prosecutor from LAPD, or excuse me, from Los Angeles County District Attorney, believes the motive was that Durst was contacted by, he says, LAPD, which may, or excuse me, Susan Berman was contacted by LAPD, which doesn't make sense because LAPD would not interview her on a Westchester County, New York case ever.
Right.
Now, they might make contact and might want to arrange a meeting on behalf of Westchester County. That I could see. That's unclear at this point, but what I can tell you is that Durst's defense team is basically, you know, putting Westchester County DA to the wall and saying they're trying to subpoena Jeanine Pirro. I don't recall if she's ever been on your show. I'd be kind of surprised if she wasn't over the years. But she's the former Westchester District Attorney who reopened the investigation into Durst, which they believe is the impetus for why Susan Berman was killed vis-a-vis Durst in 2000. Because what they believe is that Susan Berman had information regarding Kathleen Durst's murder. So much so that Kathy Durst is said to have called her, I believe it was her intern rotational supervisor, the Monday after she went missing, saying she didn't feel well, wouldn't be in. The theory is obviously that Kathy Durst was already deceased, so who's the woman that made the call? Because that's undisputed, that somebody called,
right,
naming themselves as Kathy Durst. And the theory is that Susan Berman, who would have done anything with a very special friendship with Bobby Durst, acted in that capacity. Not just that. Susan Berman was a daughter of a well-known mafia gentleman who actually died of a heart attack and didn't die, you know, violently, but was involved in the whole Las Vegas scene when, you know, the Wynns and the those different, with the Bugsy Siegel and that different crime family was operating there, was the daughter of a mobster, ended up writing a book about it. Some believe that she was in the process of writing about other mobster issues, and that might have been the impetus for somebody to kill her.
Blake from Blink on Crime is here. We're talking about Robert Durst, as Blink calls, the Houdini of criminal prosecution. What about his lawyers, Chip Lewis and Dick DeGuerin? Let's talk about them a little bit.
Well, you know, as much as I believe that he's got some culpability, they're one of the best and most brilliant legal teams I've seen in a while. They absolutely have their finger on the, they did have their finger on the pulse of the Galveston community. They, you know, within the trial, they had the jury laughing at Bob Durst. When he was outwardly discussing how he went about creating the persona of a woman that he intended to live by in Galveston, because as he puts it, you know, Jeanine Pirro, the former DA, had very publicly reopened this investigation. He didn't want to be Robert Durst. He wasn't admitting guilt. He just said, you know, these people are dogging me. I don't want to be that person anymore. So, you know, he developed this woman who was actually named after a classmate of his. And so what they were able to do, Dick DeGuerin, Chip Lewis, a few other gentlemen were able to do, were able to engage this jury in Texas, no less. We're talking about the state that has the number one rate of putting offenders to death.
Exactly.
In capital cases. And Durst was a New Yorker. He, at the time, he was a cross-dressing New Yorker. So that's kind of a big deal to be able to come away with a win there. But they were able to show that there was simply no way that the prosecution met their burden and was able to establish that Durst intentionally murdered Morris Black. And they had him testify. I mean, he was under every sort of microscope you can imagine. Durst is clearly eccentric. One of the, you know, if you want to call it charms that he has, is, and I have found this to be fairly true, is he doesn't have much of a capacity to be deceptive. Even if he is being deceptive, when he speaks, it's almost ambiguous, if that makes sense.
Sure, yep. Well, you know, this is a hard case to follow unless you're really, you know, familiar with what's gone on going back to the original. But you see a picture of Dirtz looking from the back seat of the police car, looking out and smiling, and you just have to wonder just how much he's really enjoying this, and how much more of the story is actually going to come out. What's his status as we speak?
That's a great question, Dean, and I will say he does look maniacal.
That's a good term, yeah.
He does look maniacal in that term, or excuse me, in that image, and he doesn't look as frail as other images that you will see of him. He's recently had brain surgery. He has a brain shunt. I believe he had encephalitis. I don't know if that was as a follow-up to esophageal cancer, but what the latest is, and this is entirely interesting, is today he was in court very briefly because, as I wrote, the preliminary hearing from last week was postponed till Thursday because the two FBI agents and the state police trooper refused to show at the preliminary hearing. That's a first for me, Dana. I've never seen that before.
Yeah, we'll get into that in a bit. But
right. So the status is that he showed up briefly today for the extradition issue, which they postponed till Thursday to address all of the outstanding issues together. And the position of his defense team is they want him on a plane yesterday to face extradition, because if they don't function in extradition within 30 days, which that shot clock is up next week, then they don't have to. And they want his team, and I get this defensively, his team wants to face these charges, because as I'm sitting here right now, Dana, if everything that I have read, and I do have some documents that are the search warrants and documents that I know will be relied on that trial, if everything they have is what I have seen, this is very far from a slam dunk with a man with his means.
I want to ask about the law enforcement not appearing, but some of the critics will say that because of the docuseries jinx, that prosecution jumped the gun a little bit. What about that?
I would be one of those people that would agree with that. I would say that entirely. I would say that if you go back and you look at what they're claiming to be evidentiary in terms of issuing an arrest warrant for Susan Berman's murder, it is highly, highly relevant to these writing samples. But these writing samples were in existence years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
He had already determined that he was most likely, air quote here, most likely, because, you know, I'm trained in forensic linguistics in some form of document examination, but I'm trained to be able to turn them over to the people that really know what they're doing. But I can tell you that is so not considered, you know, the forensic breakthroughs of today, and is never going to carry as the weight of evidence a capital case, in my view. And I don't care if there's 11, you know, experts that are willing to qualify that is his writing. Because a defense will show you 10 or 11 more as to why, you know, those are, you know, that's junk science, if you will. You know, you always get into those debates, especially forensically.
Sure.
You can't deny that, you know, the warrant was issued on the same evidence that they have had. There's no new evidence at all. You know what was new? He was under surveillance by the FBI for a minimum of 35 days prior to his arrest, and prior to his arrest warrant. Now, I've not seen, it's not been made public, the arrest warrant affidavit out of Los Angeles that we're talking about. So nobody knows what that, you know, that looks like in terms of probable cause. But I have seen it otherwise, and it's thin. I just believe that it's one of these issues that they knew, because Jarecki, you know, was open. He did, I want to say, maybe one day's worth of interviews before their attorneys shut them down after this, you know, mind-numbingly unbelievable finale, which, by the way, nothing got leaked about Durst's arrest until the following day. That in itself should tell you something.
Yeah.
This doesn't happen.
No. Yeah. You know, let's get into the law enforcement. You're right. I've never heard of that either, and I've been in the business a long, long time. What's up with that?
I believe it's possible that Durst is facing federal charges. And I say that for a couple of reasons. One, he was under surveillance by the FBI and with a member of a task force, a violent task force out of LAPD. Now, that doesn't give it federal jurisdiction. However, they didn't arrest him. They interrogated him. They searched his hotel room before they had a warrant, by the way. And I believe entirely that is why the law enforcement officials, that was two FBI agents and a Louisiana state trooper, were advised not to attend, because it is that thin. I believe that warrant is going to get thrown out. And I believe, you know, in Louisiana, what he's charged with in terms of a felon carrying a firearm, it's nonspecific on their statute as to what felony qualifies to be able to not carry a firearm. So technically speaking, under the law, that's not an infraction. He didn't violate anything. And it wasn't an open sight. It wasn't what's called, you know, a plain view. So that was issued before a warrant. Somebody found, he told them where it is. He absolutely said that. Now, I understand his defense has subpoenaed lobby footage from the hotel, where it clearly and plainly shows them approaching him, telling them who he is, asking him questions, etc., etc. And I'm positive he didn't give them consent to search. So, I mean, he was under surveillance for 40 days. They knew that he was withdrawing up to $9,000 a day for 35 straight days.
Jeez.
How are you going to say that you didn't know he was a suspect of something?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. We're talking about Robert Durst, the HBO documentary. Okay, let's get to this. We've got about, 25 minutes left, but lots to talk about still. Let's get to the microphone, the I killed them all, or whatever it was that he said. The legal beagles are out there saying there's no way in hell that that's going to be able to be used against him, that he knew exactly what he was saying, that some say it was all set up for the show, you know, what better ending for... Anyway, let's talk about that. What happened?
Well, I would agree that I don't think it'll ever see the inside of a courtroom as evidence. I don't believe that for a second. And I don't think it was contrived. But I do think that an individual has an expectation of privacy when they go to the loo. It's not a crime. No. You know, under the law, it's not a crime to talk to yourself. It's not a crime to, if I walk down the street and whatever you can imagine.
I'd have been in jail years ago. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. There's no set of circumstances where that's a crime. In context, in Jinx, of course, it was, you know, climactic.
Right.
And, you know, Herculeanly, you know, for lack of a better term, climactic. And it absolutely looked like there's this man, you know, off his rocker. But this is the part where I want to weigh in on some observations. And that is, there was only twice that Durst was interviewed for this series. And he resisted being interviewed the second time. For, we believe, years. And according to some, he was interviewed 2 years after the first interview. There's no set of circumstances where I believe he didn't know about this letter, or he didn't know. I mean, you're talking about a guy that, if you believe he's, let's just say for the sake of argument, you believe he's guilty of what he's guilty of. You then, if that's true, you then have to believe this guy's got a pipeline of information that he's paying for, that comes his way before anybody else knows it. And I believe that. We're talking about, you know, somebody with, you know, as we say, well, we used to say in Jersey, now we say in PA, he's got more money than God. He's just really on, you know, connected to that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's research that my team has done that would lead me to believe that he has advisors. And I'll give you an example. In terms of background and research, I can tell you that he's paid a ton of cash for what's called like a Google scrub or link scrub or things connected to his name scrub. You get trained to know how to see those things, and he's done that. So my point is, if somebody's going that mile, if you will, they're very aware of the parallel activities that are going on. And I don't think you'd interview anybody that knows him or knew some of these victims that wouldn't agree with that.
Yeah. Now, we see something played out on television. HBO, you know, whatever. It doesn't matter what network it is.
Sure.
And the confession and the forensics and the letter and all this sort of stuff. And then it comes to trial and to try and find a jury that isn't somewhat biased by this or somewhat influenced by this. For those out there that don't understand, how much will the HBO series either affect it negatively or positively as far as a conviction goes?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think you and I know the result of some high-profile prosecutions and their failures more than most. And in this case, you know, vis-a-vis Casey Anthony being a prime example, in that jurisdiction, you know, it's really hard to get convicted. Ask Robert Blake. Ask O.J. Simpson. They're just, you know, in a land where people are used to the blurred line of acting and reality, in more ways than one, and in no way am I insulting that, you know, possible jury pool. I'm not. I'm just saying it. You know, when you're in, when you're driving up and down the street and you're, you know, in Paramount traffic and the 405 is blocked for 5 hours with, craft service trucks and things along that, you just live amongst them in a different way. You just have an altered sense of, you know, what goes on and the fact that things can be made up, really. And that's a problem. It's a problem for a couple of reasons. One, these people, Andrew Jarecki, Mark Smerling, Zach Pinois, who is the editor, they're going to be witnesses. There's no question they're not going to be witnesses because they openly discuss how they're going to confront Durst. They openly discuss how they don't want to elicit additional, and this is a quote, additional evidence, using the word evidence. They openly discuss how, who's retired now, but how, you know, the aspects of the case that involved the lead investigator at the time, who was Paul Coulter, on video, in the series. There's no getting around. They have consulted with law enforcement in this case. They have consulted with Jeanine Pirro. She appears in the series. There's a part of me, Dana, that, as you know, I told you that Robert Durst actually came to Jarecki and proposed this idea. There's a part of me that thinks this guy is so freaking smart that he wagged the dog.
Yeah.
Know what I mean by that?
Yep. No, I...
Not be remotely surprised. In fact, today as I sit here, that's what I think he did. I think he went, you know what, I'm tired of running from this.
Yeah, let's have some fun now. Yeah.
Yeah, this is a sympathizer. Clearly, Jarecki's movie. You know, this is a sympathizer. Although he gets me in the bad ways, he obviously is more sympathetic than he thinks I'm evil. So how about taking this as a PR campaign?
Yeah. Yeah, and that could be too, but there's no doubt that he's written, directed, and produced this. And now, whether it goes anywhere or not, who knows? The Houdini of prosecutions, the system, HBO, the writers, television, Jeanine Pirro, all that sort of stuff. This is a wide open question. How will this affect Blink from Blink on Crime, future series like this, or directors, producers, writers that have another story that they want to deal with will this kibosh it, or will we see many more stories like this?
Again, that's a fantastic question, because, you know, I don't know that I've thought about it before you just asked me. And I will say that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago in response to a piece that I wrote that I was almost happy about HBO's depiction of the Jinx, because in the end, no matter how you look at this, good, bad, or indifferent, he's in custody.
Right.
And I have no doubt in my mind he's in custody because of this series. That doesn't mean it's right. It doesn't mean it's going to stick. It just means there was action. And I don't think Jarecki went into it. I mean, he's you know, obviously he's a he was a documentarian. He's done another one. He was a filmmaker, a movie maker. He's got money. He didn't do it for the money. This was self-financed, I want to say, to the tune of about $4 million, and it took a while until they found the outlet to which they would distribute it. But in the past, I've been pretty vocal about HBO's coverage of the West Memphis 3.
Yes.
And also a piece called There's Something Wrong with Aunt Diane, which was about Diane Schuler, who was a New York woman who ended up killing, I want to say, 9 people.
Oh, I watched that. Every time I watch that, the hair in the back of my neck stands up, I'll tell you.
Well, you know why it stands up? It does. And you know why it stands up on the back of my neck, Dana? And that's because they paid her husband $150,000, which, you know what he did? He went and hired attorneys to sue his brother-in-law and sister-in-law, whose 3 daughters were killed.
Yeah, jeez.
And so for me, walking away, I went, what are you doing? You know, the Michael Moore, the this, that, like, enough.
Yeah.
You know, let's talk about how do we, and because that's obviously my bailiwick, how do we use media to put bad people where they belong? Wouldn't that be an idea? I mean, it might not sell as much, I guess, but let's try it. And so for me, when I saw it, I was entirely, it was different. I guess from a criminologist's point of view, it's fascinating. I believe he's involved. I believe he's smarter than most. And these are components of criminology that need to be studied and need to be factored into data and case studies. So from the clinical side, I couldn't be more fascinated in the guy, because from, you know, the age of 7 to, he's, I believe, 71 right now.
Right.
You couldn't find a more, like I said, diabolical, interesting, you know, you've got money, you've got access, you've got crime. You know, those are things, those are components within that matrix that we all learn and talk about that are critically important. But as far as how it's going to change the face, I don't know that you're going to like this answer any better, but I think that... In terms of, you know, the wildly, you know, popular media outcome, I think it's going to make tons more. I think it's going to make people that can't get movies made documentarians.
Yep.
That's what I think. I think that, you know, it was glossy, it was beautiful, it was extravagant, he's interesting. I think high-profile cases find, you know, combined with reality, combined with outcome, are very desirable in terms of, you know, what people want to watch, and they're different.
And you're right. And a docuseries, call it whatever you want. We've seen a lot of the crime-related shows that talk about the case, maybe as it's going on, analyze it, so to speak. But to actually have, you know, you mentioned Anthony Drew Peterson is another one. To have the accused or the suspect directly involved in that production is rare, but we're going to see more and more of that. Blink, we've got about 5 minutes or so left. I want to ask you this, and again, it's a wide open question. With today's media, social media, internet, television, HBO, you name it, all that sort of stuff, and we touched on it somewhat with Dirtz. Did he plan this all? Was it his last hurrah, so to speak? What do we do? How do we handle the next one? The next Robert Dirtz that's out there, the next docuseries that's out there. And, you know, we're big about victims here. We talk about victims, but the focus seems to be on Mr. Durst, and he's loving it. We do hear about the victim a little bit, but how do we deal with the families and what they think of all of this?
You know, that again, that's an excellent question, Dana. Here's the issue. We go back to, and I hate discussing this because it sounds like a negative, and it is, but it has to do with what type of investigation went forward at the time.
Right.
And there is no doubt that when you're looking at this, you know, offender or you know, accused suspect at the time who has, as I, you know, as I quipped, more money than God, it's intimidating. It is very intimidating, and I don't care what form of law enforcement there is. There's just not a lot of these people of means like that that are arrested with no evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's unfortunate because, you know, Kathy Durst was a loved person by her friends and family. She was, you know, a burgeoning doctor. She was, and Durst admits this, she was an abused woman looking to get out of a bad situation, and she didn't deserve what befell her. And I can't imagine what that family goes through in any capacity. I know they were very active in the investigation at some point. I think we have to encourage our families to, if they're not getting what they need, to escalate the situation. And I will be the first person to tell you that could be very difficult for a mourning family, a grieving family. It's enough for them sometimes to get out of bed, you know?
Right.
And sometimes their coping mechanisms want them just to forget. So dogged pursuit of law enforcement, who they for at least a time trust to get done what they need to get done, escapes them. So that's part of it. There's no set of circ. I mean, Durst's house in West Salem, which I don't believe she's there, was not searched until 2000. I mean, you're talking 8 years after his wife went missing. That's a problem.
Right.
So to start with, how do we address it? It's going back into the investigative activity and saying, here's what we did wrong, here's what we won't do wrong again, and here's what we need to do to correct it. I mean, these things, it's not a coincidence that these things heated up after this was made. I mean, this thing started shooting in 2011. Here we are 2015 with the final product, and most of these warrants weren't sworn till new warrants weren't sworn until January of this year. You know, so for anybody to say that this documentary didn't have a profound impact on, you know, the investigation progressing, it's just not true.
You always hate when I ask you this, but I'll behave myself. But will the jury ever see this?
I don't know. Right now, let me put it to you this way. I believe that the charges that he's facing in New Orleans will be dropped.
Right.
If they don't drop them, there's some political or other motivation between New Orleans and LAPD that is involved, because there's no reason for them. I mean, even when he was arrested for stealing a sandwich in Bath, Pennsylvania, which at that time was a felony, for other things. I believe he also had a weapon, et cetera, at that time. They dropped everything so he could be extradited to Galveston to face trial in the Morris Black murder. That's exactly what should be happening. I don't know why Mark Burton has his heels dug in there. In fact, in some legal communities, everybody's going, you know, you want a slice of that pie? Like, what is it? But in terms of LAPD, I don't believe for a second first of all, Durst is not well. He's suffering from esophageal cancer. He's frail. He's not eating. I don't believe for a second he would ever plead. And I think that's why his lawyers want him up there and want to enjoy a speedy trial, because if the evidence that they have today is what they intend to take to court. And make no mistake, I have no doubt they'll proffer a plea to him. I know they will, and he won't take it. Why would he?
Yeah.
He's gotten away with it before. He's gotten away with everything. Why would he want to die in prison?
Yeah, taking a plea is too quick. He's having too much fun right now.
Yeah, I mean, I just think he thinks that everybody's dumber than him.
Yeah.
And that it's, you know, the, being convicted is for other people. Being convicted is for a different group of people. He's lived his life that entire way. I mean, you're talking about a guy that had aliases when he was in his early 20s. And had, I mean, he was a millionaire. He was subject to, you know, a formidable fortune, you know, a $1 billion fortune, and he was using aliases. Now, that tells me this guy didn't like being who he was from a very young age, or he liked being other people, which in itself, you know, is reflective of some of his psychiatric issues. But if this does go to court, Dana, no, I do not believe for a second he will be convicted. I think he'll walk. And I think it's arrogant and hubris if anybody thinks differently. The way that this case is structured right now, I think they jumped the gun. I think they were looking to say, okay, you know, this, the time is now, because how can we not arrest this guy? Because when the public sees the evidence that this documentary is going to put on, we're going to look like idiots. You know, and you recall the years of Daryl Gates running the LAPD, right?
Right. Yep, absolutely.
So, I mean, this is the place where movie stars, other than a handful, Ronnie Spector comes to mind, but if I'm not mistaken, he had a mistrial the first time around.
Yep.
Get away with things. And this jury pool believes in things. And like it or not, he's just a eccentric, quirky guy that a lot of people can relate to on a lot of levels. He does not come off as, you know, this evil, schematic, predatory man. He's teensy.
Wow.
And that's part of our, you know, like it or not, that's part of what a jury takes in. They were successful before. They will be successful again if they don't bolster the case that I believe that they have.
Well, it will be interesting. The story is about Robert Dirks, the docuseries Jinx on HBO, and of course blinkoncrime.com is our favorite sister blogger and crime analyst. Always a pleasure, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you. Great to talk to you, Dana. Be well.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
You got it. Bye-bye.
And, you know, just if you have HBO, sit back and watch it or Google it, and I think you could probably watch it online, and it's a fascinating case. And the hidden microphone, or the microphone that he knew that was on, and he goes to the bathroom and says, "I killed them all." Is there expected privacy while you're in the bathroom if you commit or if you admit to an offense of murder? Yeah, the story is yet to be told, and there's lots more to tell. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed the show. That's it for tonight. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. We're on scaredmonkeysradio.com and, of course, access Channel 7, and we'll see you again real soon.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.